Thank you for the mountain of questions that you've given us. We're not going to get through them all in the next 15 minutes, which is all we've got time for. But do follow up afterwards with Kev, and I'm sure we'll be touching on many of these subjects in the coming months and years as well. Right, let's kick off with a question that was handed in last week. How should we straddle submission and standing up for Christian beliefs, especially in cases where they seem mutually exclusive? So, for example, a trainee doctor who is called on to carry out an abortion. So thinking back to last week and submission to authorities.
Yeah, thank you. I actually asked Chev, who's one of our doctors, we've got a few medics at church, I asked him about this. You don't have to help perform an abortion against your conscience. So that's the kind of technicality. How that then plays out in practice, in terms of the conversations you might need to have, if that's your stand, the way it affects your witness, the way it affects your job prospects, all of that, there'd then be lots more to say. And I would encourage you, if you're a Christian in law or science or medicine or whatever your thing is, if there's ethical issues around potential conflicts, do find the other Christians at church who are in the same trade, if you like, and older godly people in your line will, I'm sure, want to help you. But yeah, don't be surprised when you have to say no to certain things and when there are consequences for that in any profession.
Brilliant, thank you. Getting on to a question that straddles last week and this week. Sometimes we completely contextualize away certain verses, like those affirming slavery, because we realize God was not promoting slavery as much as he was talking about proper behavior given a cultural institution of the time, i.e. slavery. Why can't we apply the same reasoning here, but to the cultural institution of patriarchy, which was prevalent at the time of the Bible's writing? So, for example, God gives advice on how to exist in both slavery and patriarchy, but doesn't endorse those institutions as much as he just recognizes them as staples of the era. What would you say to that?
Thank you. So I think I want to affirm that everything you're saying there about slavery, and I want to say that marriage is in a different category because God created marriage as a good thing from the beginning of creation. God did not create slavery. Slavery is part of the brokenness of the world. Marriage is part of the goodness of the world and God's good design. And even there in Genesis, before the fall, it does say that the man was created first and that the woman was created as his helper, which is not patronizing. It's not like Santa's little helper kind of thing. That's language that's used about God as our helper. But the New Testament takes it that everything about marriage applies in every era of the Bible, that it's an institution that transcends the eras of the Bible, that in every era of the Bible, it's between one man and one woman, and where the man has a leadership role. So that's part of the difference. Lots more to say.
Is there a time when Christians can take up arms against their oppressors? So, for example, a Christian village in Syria or Iraq, which eventually decides to fight back against Daesh.
Thank you. That's a very interesting and good question. I'd make the distinction in what we said last week about what a given individual and your responsibility as an individual living in a state is, which is basically to submit to that state, unless they ask you to do things that would be wrong for a Christian. I distinguish that from the role of governing authorities themselves. So a Christian council or a Christian village or a Christian government has a role in actually promoting good in the world and seeking to subdue evil. The passage from last week talks about that as being the role of governments. If you can look back at that at 2 verse 14. So if you're part of the governing authority or something that in a situation of anarchy has become the governing authority, that's different. Then yeah, there is the right to, as part of, and even war can be justified in that context, promote God's good. But that's different from what you as an individual, you're not allowed to declare, you know, I'm a unilateral state, you know, the independent state of Kev has now been formed up here. Yeah, Rob, you're not part of it. That's not something that you're allowed to do. That was just an example.
It's okay, that wasn't loaded. I was just pretending. If women are seen as equals with men, why does Peter refer to them as weaker vessels?
Yeah, as I said, I think it's just a recognition that men have been the abusers of history. That's borne out through history. And whether men's advantage is physical or whether it's to do with the leadership role, that advantage, if there is one, is not to be asserted in a way that's to demean and downgrade the wife. She's to be honoured at every opportunity.
Brilliant. What does it actually mean in practice to be submissive to your husband? What does it look like in marriage in practice? And one person also asked on that topic. A few of you asked about this. One person says, if being a husband means that you have to be listened to by your wife, does that mean that you don't have to listen to your wife if you're a husband?
No, it definitely doesn't mean that, because you've got to listen to live with her in an understanding way, haven't you? And it's just important to recognise the potential for sin exists at every opportunity here. The bloke in his leadership role is tempted to abuse that leadership. The woman, given the bloke has a leadership role, might feel like I can just be a completely passive individual spiritually. That would be wrong as well. And sin exists as a possibility on the other side as well. So the women are not to manipulate the fact that the husband is to understand you. So wives, you need to give space for the fact that he might be understanding you and still disagreeing with you and suggesting something else for the good of the family. I hope you've got space for that, rather than just saying, you've got to understand me, therefore you've got to do what I say. And likewise, the husband isn't to be so understanding that he just gives up all responsibility in the family. Oh, well, she's better at the money side of things, she's better with the kids, she's better at doing the kids' spiritual life, she's better at thinking about how we're involved in church. In other words, everything important about our life, she does better. You're not to do that as the husband. What does it then mean in practice if you're doing it properly? Well, Laura and I were talking about this just the other night, and in a godly situation, it should be a lot easier than what's envisaged here, which is another reason to say, don't marry someone who's not on the same page spiritually. Because if they've got the same priorities about God and the gospel and Christian ministry, you'll have far fewer situations where conflict will come in. But it does still come in, because we're all broken. And so there might be an occasion where the woman has to say, well, let's go back to one of our examples from earlier. If the bloke is a doctor saying, I'm not going to perform an abortion, and the wife says, have you thought about the implications for your career and our family and the money and all of that? And he says, no, this would be the right thing to do. This is the way I'm leading our family. Well, Sarah's example says, don't be frightened by that. If your husband is trying to lead the family in a godly way, submit to that and trust that God has you covered. That would be one example, but there'd be loads more to say.
Okay. On Wednesday, we saw Romans 12, where you talked about everybody contributing to the church family according to their gifts. Well, what if I'm married to somebody? Sorry, this is a woman speaking here. Don't get confused. What if I'm married to somebody who's less gifted in leadership than I am? Does that mean that I ought to be thinking about using leadership gifts even though I'm a woman?
Yes, definitely. And you'll have other contexts in which to use them. But this is part of kind of God's organisation. It's not actually about which one is the most gifted in leadership in the family. It's part of what God's calling to the man to lead the family. Now, in that situation, obviously, you're going to want to maximise the fact that your wife's a gifted leader, but that the husband can't use that to get out of his role. And if this is you and you're in our church family, I want to say, come to that evening that I mentioned on the 14th of November. We'd love to help you think about being released into the gifts that God has given you in the church and in all kinds of contexts where your leadership, and if you've got gifts of godliness and Bible teaching as well, there'll be loads of opportunities to use those gifts in a church family like this. So yes, we want you to flourish in those gifts.
Brilliant. Thank you. Now, you said being like Jesus has the power to change the world. Can you elaborate?
That's what I meant by the 2 verse 12 verse. So the world is changed when non-Christian people see your good deeds and glorify God, that the good lives of Christian people can actually turn non-Christian people into God glorifiers. Do we trust that when it comes to submission? Or do we think that Christians need to take control of the levers of society? And it's quite a challenge to us, I think. Can we trust that the Jesus way of the gentle and quiet spirit that submits and trusts the Lord, that that's actually the beautiful life that men and women are to live in this society, and it will make people go, wow, I want to find out more about that.
on that, somebody's asked the question about how chapter 3 talks about the manner of living, but where's the place for speaking the gospel? Is it just the way we live that changes the world, or should there be a balance between living and speaking the gospel?
That's a good... Is that you planting a question for your talk next week, Rob?
No.
That comes up in chapter 3 later on. Definitely there's a place for speaking, because we're meant to be ready so that when people ask us questions about these strange lives, that we're ready to respond. But we've actually already had it in 2 verse 9. So we're to proclaim the excellencies of him. 2 verse 9 and 10. It's partly a lifestyle thing. It's partly a proclaiming thing. And both need to go together, don't they? Because otherwise, people will see our good lives. And what will we do? We sort of take a bow and go, yes, well done us. We're such good people. No, we're meant to tell the story of our great God.
Okay, brilliant. Some very practical questions now. Should submission to husbands be something that starts on the night of our marriage? Or should it be a sliding scale that begins as we consider marriage together through dating?
Thank you. I think engagement is obviously a big... If you've made that decision, then that's a key thing. But I think the reason I mentioned that is because sometimes couples default into this kind of submission and leadership role before the bloke has actually committed to marry the girl, and she maybe moves to a different city or even different country following this man who has made no commitment to her. And the reason I mentioned it is to say to you girls, you shouldn't follow a man in that way if he's not committed to you. And so you need to be really careful about going out situations, because you might not end up getting married. And the more you default into acting like you are, the more painful it will be when you split up. Of course, as you go on in dating, you'll talk about how will this look, what will our different roles be, what will we do with our life. And as you talk about that, of course, then the wife wants to see that this man is a spiritual man, that he's got a clear sense of what it would mean to be a godly family. And he's going to want to think that this woman doesn't just, every time he suggests something, she's going to kind of disagree and mock him or whatever. So you need to examine those things. Engagement is the key moment, I think, where you then can start say, okay, what does it mean to live like this as a married couple? Because you've committed to that. But that should be a big moment of change, I think.
Should all Christians aspire towards marriage?
No, definitely not. So 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and 7 are a great couple of chapters. Chapter 7 talks about the advantages of singleness in a world that is broken and that is temporary. Actually, there are great advantages in the single life. And if you know Christians who've decided not to get married, or it wasn't a choice, it just never happened for them, often they're people that God has used greatly in the extra relationships that they're able to cultivate, the extra time they've had for prayer and all kinds of other ministries, sort of crisis type ministries, where a single person can often much more easily say, I can drop everything and come. Missionary work, where often pioneer work, single people can often much more easily get involved. So there's great, great godliness and great esteem in the New Testament for the gift of singleness. And I worry that in our culture, we maybe don't even believe those bits of the Bible.
And then finally, I think we've come to the end of our time, but time for just one more, which I think will be very relevant for lots of the young people here, Kev.
Okay.
Is there such a thing as a wrong marriage decision?
Wow, okay. So, yeah, I'm saying, I did say, didn't I, that a Christian should marry a Christian. We haven't got into that one. I mean, there's a whole... Please, if you're tempted to marry someone who isn't a Christian, that's very painful, because obviously you think they're great. That's why you want to marry them. But there are some clear verses about why that would be wrong. There's also a clear sense of what the purpose of marriage is in the Bible, that it's actually to mirror the relationship between Christ and the church. How could you do that with someone who doesn't believe in Christ? And then there's a bigger picture in the Bible of all the way through the Bible, marrying people who are not part of the family of faith has been one of the key things that's led people away from God completely. So it's a big, serious thing. And it's different to say, well, before you get into that, then the word from the Lord is, don't do it, stop it. I say that as if it's dead easy. I know that in the situation it's very tough, and you want your friends to help counsel you in that. But yeah, that if you've got the freedom to make a choice, it is possible to make a right or a wrong choice on who to marry. on a godly or unless godly choice. Retrospectively, which is the issue in 1 Peter and actually in 1 Corinthians, if you've ended up married and the other person isn't a Christian, then the word from the Lord is not get out of that marriage. It's let the church help you to work out how to be godly in that situation. But do know and speak to Christians in that situation, and they'll tell you, many of them, that it's the hardest thing in their life to be married to someone who doesn't share your faith. So take that really seriously.
Thanks, Kevin. Guys, thank you so much for your questions. Again, really important things, and sadly not enough time to get through them all. Keep asking Kev questions, keep talking with one another. We'd love to keep these conversations going.